I, with an absolute dingo-eaten sense of joy.
On maynard.com.au. Hey, you! Ladies and gentlemen, I'm backstage in the bowels. In fact, I can smell decomposing food somewhere, I'm sure. I've got the tap bell now. As you noticed, in the interviews I've been using, only I have been able to use that. But, George Rupp, you can use my exclamation bell if you want.
So this is purely for emphasis?
That's right. Yeah, sure. It could be used for anything. I've used it for all sorts of stuff. I could have hepatitis B. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Hey, what do you like at the doctor? As a skeptical guy who believes in science and reason, you still must poop yourself when some tests are coming back. I'm still really nervous. Something like that, completely irrational.
My complete irrationality is sort of providing myself a silent moment of hope before I open the envelope or before I answer the phone. So, you know, results are coming in. There is that 1 second of dread, hope, whatever, where you know that whatever you're feeling, whatever you're thinking, whatever you're wanting will not affect the ink which is already printed on this page.
This is a touch quantum.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Totally. Total Schrödinger. Dr. Schrödinger,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Here's the results. What are the results? Yeah.
Right. It's not a cat. It's just, you know, fingers up your poop.
One of the things I enjoy about the Geologic podcast is you bring this world of the artist and his journey through the world with the skepticism, with everything that goes on. I find I'm alone in the bath having listened to it on a Sunday afternoon, which is often the most horrible day of the week because you've got to go to work next day, and I often have to get up at 4 or 5 a.m. to go to work and have a 2.5 hour commute.
What is your favorite day of the week?
Thursday. Because
totally, right?
Thursday.
Potential.
I don't work Fridays, so my Thursday afternoon is other people's Fridays. There's 3 days of possibilities ahead, and I have no idea.
Again, getting back to Schrödinger, it's like this quantum weekend that you haven't done it yet in an ocean of options, and that is the most sort of attractive. It's like when the meal first arrives, before the bite, that's the best part, you know, or even the ordering of it on some level of saying, this is what we're going to have. The thrill, it's all downhill from here.
Sometimes Japanese food is like that because it is so beautifully and so well prepared. You don't want to muck that up by putting it in your stomach and then pooping it out, really.
Right. Who wants to ruin these art pieces of sashimi or whatever, yeah.
With your own podcast, Stephen Fry has written about this and talked about it, and thou shalt not contradict Stephen Fry, as the song goes. He said that you've got to be careful having your own opinion page or podcast and fall into the trap of thinking that your opinion weighs more than other people's. Is that something you're aware of sometimes?
Oh, completely. I would hope that whenever I do give an opinion, it's always with a caveat of like, you know, this is what I think. It could be right, could be wrong. This is what works for me. This is what I enjoy. If I'm talking about how awful, you know, a film is or an album is or some experience was.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Prometheus Ride Out, between you and The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, there's this stuff over the other side of the room there. I'm never going to go see that film now.
Well, you have to see it, but you have to spend as little money as possible on it. So whether it comes on TV or whatever rental system you guys have, I don't know how you rent with kangaroos or whatever system of barter you guys have, I'm not sure. Yeah, see it and do the Mystery Science Theater thing where you just sort of yell at the screen while it's happening. Because if you look at it as this bizarre performance piece of bad science, it's actually quite enjoyable. But going into it with the expectations I had of it being, oh, I don't know, a Ridley Scott film, then and your testicles just rescend back up into your chest, because this movie is a very attractive person who then opens their mouth. And you realize, oh, you spend all of your time making sure that you're really attractive and you've never read a sentence. That's what this film is.
I have a present for you. Now, this probably won't, you might not even enjoy this, but this is an Australian production called Danger 5. I have absolutely nothing to do with this production. I've only ever interviewed the people involved with it once or twice. Okay. They got $1.5 million Australian to do 12 episodes and a web series, and you can see the size of the cast there. And they've done the show in, if Ironside had decided, the people who made Ironside had decided to do combat in a sort of a world, in a Thunderbirds kind of way, basically, yes. And it's cheaper scope. They did their own music. They made their own music sound like stock music and that sort of thing. They are greatly influenced by the movie Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs. You can have a look at that, and it's yours to keep.
I'm looking at the back here. How could I not watch this? Because there is a Tyrannosaurus who is not only drinking a martini, but is dressed as a Nazi. I mean, I am in. I am so in. Actually, I almost want to stop this interview right now so I can go dive into this. Plus, there's a smoking dingo or some kind of whatever that is. I'm not sure what that is, this looks amazing.
I just gave them. Now I've got an unusual list here. You're one of the few people who I can talk to on a lot of levels about anything. And by the way, we had a great chat at the Dirty Disbelievers that time. I got up at 5 a.m. in the morning and rang you on Skype, and we had a chat. And I had to edit that down to some ridiculously short level of 10 minutes from a 45-minute chat we had,
which you did brilliantly, which was lovely.
Before we get on this too, you've actually done your own TV pilot recently, and you didn't want to jinx it by talking about it on your podcast. So can you say anything about it at all at the moment?
Yeah, and it wasn't not jinxing it. When you form that sentence that I'm working on my pilot, or you know, we're filming a pilot, you just every corpuscle of just embarrassment kind of you know tightens, because you just everyone claims that, everyone says that, everyone has an idea for a show. I would love to just sort of have a product that, you know, this is where it is.
Can I give you a little bit of advice now?
Sure.
I've been involved in 100 or so pilots in my life. I've also been involved in a pilot that got me a national breakfast show on the radio. I've also been involved in a pilot that got me my own national complete creative control television show on an MTV type network. Yes, sometimes they do happen. And when they do happen, you think you're going to be jumping around like joy, but it's so surreal, you can't believe it. When they said to me, would you like to host a Triple J breakfast show? I actually said to them, I'll have to think about it.
Right.
And I started to leave the room, and I thought, what the fuck are you doing? They just wanted to ask, would you like to host the Nash? And I said, no, of course. When do you want me to start? Exactly. When you get it, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, to me, being here at TAM is a level of that very surreal. Are you sure you want me to do this? You're all okay with this? Has been voted on by someone? I mean, there's no blackmail involved. Like, this is okay.
I'm not being punked.
Right. I'm waiting for Ashton to pop out from behind James Randi's beard at some point. You know, I mean, a lot of my family and friends often sort of say, like, look, you have a skill set. You are there for a reason. You obviously are okay at it. Accept it. Perfect example, during the SGU, the Skeptics Guide show today, Steve Novella had this idea of, we want you to be a guest on the show, but let's do a thing where you kind of keep interrupting us and you want to sort of sneak into the show. And we keep saying no, until finally you actually invade one of the video pieces that we've done, where it seems we've pre-filmed this with Dr. Rachy, of all people. You're wanting to sneak into the show is so great you can actually traverse space and time and video. Funny bit. And my concern was that that is my constant state of mind, that I worry I'm coming across that way.
Ah.
And I said, Steve, you've really mined into something which is very sort of deep within me.
So you're worried that people go, oh, Gio, he's such a tryhard.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, here he goes again. Like, okay, we got it. You know, you don't have enough stage time? Like, guitar? You brought a guitar? George Trott brought a guitar somewhere. Oh, great. Wow, what are the odds of that? You know, which to me is just this terror idea of look at me. I don't want to come across that way.
Someone who had done a PhD wouldn't really be all that reticent about telling people at a conference what they did, really, would they?
It's interesting.
Where you'd be worried about overexposing yourself, I'm sure that guy would be happy to tell as many people about his PhD discovery about string theory or whatever as much as he liked. Do you think the egos are very different within those worlds?
I'm sure you could have some physicist who is just a complete douche, you know, who is just, there's Friedrich again. Okay, we got it. You know, string theory, great.
Yep. Which is where we were about the pilot. I was so interested in hearing about it. And can you tell us much about it? Was it Strange Roads? Was that the name of it?
The potential name is Strange Roads, and it's morphed over time. I mean, initially I was contacted because I was local and looked interesting. Producer out of New York wanted a skeptic to balance out a show he was putting together.
And see, that's how random it is, people. Look, anyone who knows George and likes his work say, of course he'd be the guy. But not everyone knows George's work. There's one item in your life in the Venn diagram is intersected with the producer, and that's how your name got in front of him.
So you throw, you know, as many potential targets out, whether it's doing 250 podcasts or appearing on other programs or doing articles or blog posts or doing, you know, pictures, photos, whatever, and you sort of make a large wall that can be hit by the spitball of this random producer looking for certain age, certain disposition, certain look, and skeptic background. Everyone he sort of found or said that he would find seemed boring or seemed older or whatever for his needs, for what he was looking for. So it was a random phone call. We met, and I guess he seemed to think I was good on camera. I felt comfortable on camera, which is another weird psychological thing, that I'm more comfortable on stage and on camera once it's rolling than I am in the rest of my life. I'm supposed to be the center of attention when I'm on stage so I can relax and do the thing that I want to do, as opposed to, am I overstepping my bounds at this party by having my guitar with me? If you wanted to torture me, you know, have me order pizza over the phone. it's torture. But to stand in front of 1,200 people and you know, fill 6 minutes of time before the computer's ready for the next speaker, I'm fine with that. It's strange. It's strange.
And how did Strange Roads go? Hey, that was a great seg there.
How did it go?
How did it feel for you? Can you say too much about it?
From that initial thing of just getting in touch with me and being a skeptic amongst a larger cast, it got winnowed down to just me, which was going to be an adventure show where I kind of go around and look at, you know, UFO conventions and, you know, the opposite of what Tam is. Shiatsu conventions and sort of talk about stuff and be skeptical about it. It went from being that to what if we had, it's more like a desk show. So it's more like Bill Maher, more like Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart meets skepticism. Half hour, 60 minutes, we're not sure of the format, but people come in, monologue, we show a video piece of me going to whatever UFO convention, and then we bring on a person who believes in UFOs, and I talk to them, we have a little bit of a debate. We bring up an astrophysicist who talks about the unlikelihood of there being UFOs, and then we all sort of chat and wrap it up. My whole thing was to make it approachable and heated, but not confrontational.
This is what we were trying to do with the Dirty Disbelievers show, too, because you want to bring in both sides. You want to be respectful to both sides. Absolutely. And you want people to come away from the show understanding both sides and making their decision from what was presented to them.
While never backing down and being wishy-washy, but still having it be as if you're at a cocktail party where you wouldn't, you know, point your finger in someone's face and you wouldn't be a lousy host or a lousy guest. Half the audience were skeptics, half were believers, which was the producers did on purpose to sort of just see what the vibe was like. My opening monologue was about atheism, and you could sort of, you could feel half the crowd sort of folded their hands, you know, across their chest and sort of were like, okay. But slowly, I think, throughout the course of the program, the taping, I kind of not won them over, but showed that we can have a huge disagreement on that level, but we can still completely have a conversation. And by the end of the show, everybody was laughing. All who left the taping had a positive experience. Someone who believes in the craziest of things is a 100% skeptic on something else. And will say, I can't believe people believe in X. I believe in Y, and I will defend Y, and I'll go, X and Y are both baddie. I don't understand how you do either. I love that part, and I want to mine that part of everyone's brain that says, astrology is nuts, but I'm Catholic. But yeah, but obviously, water to wine and walking on, you know, resurrected. Sure, okay. Yeah,
transubstantiation, of course, that's real.
Of course, of course. You know, we're all one. You know, atheists are just one extra god away from. You know, I believe in one less god. That's the cliched thing of than any believer does. Because most, you know, people of faith don't believe in Zeus or don't believe in Mithras or don't believe in Thor, and yet they'll believe in whatever they do. So the vast majority of the options available, they don't believe in. Take that final little step, you know, and that to me is interesting, and to be able to show that to people and have it sort of reflect and say, you don't believe all these things, why don't you believe all those things?
Yes, it's a great hook with the skepticism, but to me, why, you could just go on and do like a Conan O'Brien show and bring the skepticism into it as a Trojan horse, like do the reverse of that kind of thing. Do you think that that would be some other way to do it? But do you think the skepticism is a hook for this show? Because you are funny, you do music, you can do lots of other stuff, and it is about that sort of base anyway.
Yeah, I would hope that the ultimate thing is funny. In the same way that people know Conan is a redhead, I'd love to have it be, oh, well, that guy's an atheist, but he's funny. You know, and he's talking about stuff that I might not know, or it would be nice to, yeah, not have it be the skeptic show, but Strange Roads.
I get shot by both sides quite a lot doing the Dirty Disbelievers. I remember two Thursdays ago, I was in town with Richard Saunders, and he turned to me and said, so you actually hang with people, Maynard, who would believe that they would assassinate the President of the United States? I said, yeah. He said, but that's murder. Why would someone murder someone? I said, well, Richard, they do it for $50 on the street sometimes. Political assassinations are not unknown in Europe. So the concept of the head of state being assassinated is not an unusual one. And he was like, okay. 2 hours later, I'm sitting with my friend Jay in his kitchen. He's going, I can't believe Saunders just, you know, of course he was murdered. Can anyone see the size of this conspiracy? And then he started to draw a map for me. Yes, the head of state could be assassinated, but arguing the exact opposite opinion within 2 hours. Yeah. Has that ever happened with you?
I love the devil's advocate position because it lets you sort of strengthen your own beliefs or the process of skepticism, which is ultimately a process. It's not a belief, it's a tool. So I love pointing it back at myself and saying, okay, is Frank Zappa as good as I think he is? Are the Beatles as good as they are? Defend it. Go to either side or explain why Frank Zappa is overrated and just as an exercise, you know, just as a mental exercise. But it's still kind of fun to see, okay, what could be the harm here?
It's also the root of your comedy, because sometimes comedy has to twist things or come from the opposite perspective. Absolutely. To get a funny result.
Doug Stanhope did. I don't know if you saw Doug Stanhope's stand-up.
I didn't see him here. I'm a huge fan of his work.
I mean, his topics were euthanasia, you know, defending euthanasia, that atheists should be more like L. Ron Hubbard, gay rape in public. Horrendous topics. Horrendous topics if they're just listed like that.
Well, actually, this is what I've got.
Oh, there you go.
Look, rape jokes, Jews, Tam scandal, monogamy, drunks that wail on at you at night. Now, that's a list of things, you know, that's a top show there, really. That's going to get a lot of downloads there.
I want to see the band on that show. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. And those are just the things I wanted to bring up with you there. And he brought up that. So let's dive into the first one there. Yeah. Rape jokes has suddenly talking about whether that's – in fact, I saw a great tweet about that saying everyone must get their essay in about that by 5 o'clock this afternoon because it won't be an issue after a day or two from now. And it's come up because of things that have happened. And it's something you've done on your show tangentially. And the only joke I've heard, the first time I ever heard it was on Jay Leno's show, actually. And I think it was Kid Rock or someone like that said that Osama bin Laden, they wanted to capture and torture him. They wanted to kill him. They did not want to rape him because that would be barbaric. And that sort of sums up in some ways the way it can be used.
I don't think that there is any topic that's out of bounds because it's all what you do with it. Yeah, it's completely in the delivery and the context. To use rape jokes or to use molestation or any kind of horrible issue, as long as the joke ultimately delivers something larger and more positive than just the shock of using that, it's okay. So if you're describing, like, you know, Stanhope's bit about, in essence, it was sort of saying he doesn't like seeing the pink ribbons associated with football because on Sunday, that's his day. He wants to sit. He wants to watch football. He doesn't want to think about, you know, a woman having breast cancer. He doesn't want to think about that. What he wants to think about is these, you know, these great athletes that are so superbly built, that have these incredible bodies that you just want to. And he builds into this rape fantasy, this male rape fantasy that he's at the Super Bowl bending this quarterback over, raping the quarterback, you know, that is his fantasy and that's what he should be allowed to think about on a Sunday and not some woman with breast cancer, which flips it completely and shows that, yeah, there's this dark sort of weird, you know, and he ends it was like, that's why I don't want to think about, you know, breast cancer, because ultimately I am repressing these homosexual urges that I will make fun of in anyone else and point out in anyone else, but I have this as part of the American sporting experience.
Do you think even two relatively privileged white males having a discussion about rape jokes because, you know, I'm feeling, should I even be talking about this because of who I am and where I've come from?
It's funny that I get a little more nervous seeing Jews on that list than rape jokes, because to me that's almost more, I personally run the risk of being more misinterpreted. You know, most of my friends are Jews. I have very close friends that are Jews, you know, whatever. I have close friends that are X, you know, blank, whatever it is. There is I see Jews listed amongst, you know, topics to be discussed, and that to me, I don't know if it's a sensitivity issue that's been, you know, as a Northeast American liberal, you know.
Well, that will move us on to our next topic, because that was specifically the intersection of science and junk science and science that can't be repeated. And I've mentioned this to a few people. Aran Segay, I've spoken to him with his history. I'm sure that there'd be members of your family that might have had a loss in the Holocaust or something. That's completely possible, George. The Nazis took out high-altitude experiments on concentration camp prisoners, and they got information that can be used today that can never be done again, because you can only do it if the person dies to get the result. Should that information has been used? What do you feel about that when science is forced to use information that is morally unclean?
It's such an interesting topic. It is such a weird. Not that you could justify the loss of the people that were. Experience that horridness, but maybe it wouldn't be in vain.
But does it even respect them? Because they certainly weren't volunteering for it.
I know personally, if something were to happen where I was tortured and some horrific regime was getting scientific information for whatever evil use they wanted, for lack of a better term, I think I would want that information if it could benefit humanity at some future point. I personally would want that to be available. you know, whatever your experiments are. I mean, hopefully science is for driving humanity forward.
Hang on. That might lighten it a bit. I'll tell you, you rattle on about all sorts of these things in your show, and any listener but can't help but think, gee, I'd like to know about that. In fact, Danger 5 and the movie Iron Sky have had a similar problem to what Mel Brooks had. Mel Brooks with the producers. Certain Jewish groups said, particularly, there's no mention of Jews whatsoever in Danger 5 or anything about camps and that kind of thing. And in Iron Sky, of course, we've got Nazis coming back from the moon with flying saucers, and they get their ass whipped. Now, in both these cases, they're being made fun of, but they're being concerned that in some ways being a Nazi is being made sexy through the use of comedy and films in that way. What do you think?
Right. I mean, there is a fetishism of, you know, I think that taps into some other issues, you know, of taboo for taboo's sake, that kind of stuff. I mean, the German army of the 30s had some of the most stylish uniforms ever.
Yeah, you look at the American one, kind of loose and baggy, the Russian one, what is going on with that thing over the shoulder?
Yeah, right, I mean, come on. The field babushka.
The Finnish army had it pretty down. They had, they had the cool muff hats going on, and they had better-looking ski troop uniforms, I feel. But, you know, not enough people go. See, they were put down. They didn't get the exposure they needed was the Finnish army, you know, because they had good uniforms, bad press.
If you use that look as an influence, let's say, in your fashion, you know, is that okay? Is that not okay?
Yeah, just ask David Bowie.
Right. I think of the show Hogan's Heroes, you know, taking place, of course, in a, you know, as most comedy should, in a German, you know, Nazi war camp.
And it went on for, I think, about 7 seasons. There were 2 Helgas. Bob Crane slept with both of them.
Yes, of course.
There's one episode where they actually play their real instruments in the last series. A couple of them, they have a bit of a jam. There's some, as you do in the Brady Bunch, any excuse to get a band going.
Yes.
It happens in the camp, and I think a few of them actually play their own instruments.
And, well, Bob Crane was a drummer, right? So he's playing drums in that thing. But I believe one of the things that Bob Crane said that allowed him to do the show was he said, like, Colonel Klink can never win. He can never win. He can't seem competent. We can make him think that he thinks he's competent. That's fine. But the Nazis can never be seen as successful. And that's the only way the comedy can work, which then it did. That was a huge sort of rule within that universe of Hogan's Heroes. In like Iron Sky, if the moon Nazis come and win, that's a different idea. You know, you look at Inglourious Basterds. Here is a chance, in essence, to win World War II again, which can be a very palliative, relieving kind of idea of we are going to shoot Hitler in the face. Because that's what he deserved. He shouldn't have been able to off himself relatively peacefully in his bunker. We're going to shoot him in the face. Is that Jewish revenge porn or whatever? Great. You know what? You're allowed. I think that's fine. You're allowed to do that.
I believe the phrase is they had it coming.
Yes. Yes. You know, and if that can relive pleasure in winning again against such a universal foe, okay.
I've been sitting very close to you, and you haven't noticed that we had the product of Big Pharma not far from you. Not a meter away from George Rapp. He's picking up a pen that was given to me.
Oh, yes. Nice. The Viagra pen, which apparently just you can never retract.
Hand it out to doctors, and I thought, if I'm coming to TAM, I have to have a bit of Big Pharma going on.
Nice.
And you, as the host of TAM 2012, you've seen a lot of stuff on stage, and there's been a few issues around TAM this year. And have any of them been broached on stage and spoken about? And are they even as big as we think they are?
To get your last part first, I think, like most things, like most concerns, like most news, like most things that affect us personally, it's never quite nearly as universal as one would suspect. When you are sitting in a cramped airplane seat, you imagine that the world is sitting in a cramped airplane seat. That is the nature of the human animal, is that we can basically see the horizon, which is 7 miles or whatever it is. That is your world. That is the universe that we as human animals can imagine. The universe, let alone when we're in a room or when we're in a group of people. The stuff that might affect us personally or that we hear about, we think, is much more ubiquitous than it nearly is. And statistically, it just can't be. Whatever that issue is, you know, unless that issue is the processing of oxygen, you know, which all humans do. Okay, great. I'll give you that. Yes, all humans process oxygen on some level.
Because you imagine how this looks to someone like me who I was reading all these tweets, I was reading all these blogs, and to me it looked from the other side of the world, the whole movement was tearing itself apart. It looked like that from where I was sitting, because I didn't talk to any of you on a day-to-day basis. I was just reading stuff on blogs that were all nasty. And then they got so many of them that I couldn't even go back and find out where the original cross-secting arguments were coming from. Right. It got that confusing for me.
I think, again, that is the appearance. And what you see are those who tweet and those who blog. And I don't know what the proportions are, but for every person that tweets or blogs, who is a skeptic and who's within this movement? I mean, is it 10 to 1? Is it 5 to 1? Is it 50 to 1? 100 to 1? I mean, if you were to watch American news, you would think that...
You've got to say, it's hilarious. The rest of the world doesn't exist.
Number one, the rest of the world, the rest of the planet does not exist. And children are being abducted every minute of every day. There are dangers lurking in every corner of your house, of your market, of your school, and none of that is true. I mean, just the pure, you know, how many children in the U.S. get abducted by strangers? If you were to look at the information, the educational tools that are used, the way schools teach kids to, you know, stay away from strangers, which is all great information, but it's something like 100 kids. Maybe if even that, the number is so ridiculously tiny out of the 300 million citizens. Normally it's a parent, it's an uncle, it's some. If an abduction were to occur, it's normally someone that the child knows. Murders, same deal. Most murders are
in the family.
In the family. That is never the way you lead the story, though. It is someone was murdered, shot, danger. Panic. We need to protect ourselves from the potentiality of violence. Strangers are the enemy. That thing that is unknown is the enemy. I think it's the same deal here. You are reading the tweets, you are reading the blogs of the people that are tweeting and blogging who tend to be vehement to begin with, because to have a blog, you have to have something to say. And in order to have something to say, you sort of need to look for something to say. So it's an opportunity. It's a wonderful opportunity to express yourself. But when a subject comes up like this that really isn't, and again, I don't want to diminish anyone's experience, because to the person whose child is abducted, that is the universe. That is that world that is destroyed, and I couldn't imagine the horribleness of having your child abducted or being accosted sexually. I mean, as a male, I can't imagine the equivalent. You know, it's such a different dynamic between being harassed, you know, as a woman versus as a man. I can't imagine it, so I can't almost comment on it. And the person that is harassed, the person that goes through that, I would never want to say you didn't feel what you were feeling. I could say what happened to you is not ubiquitous, is not...
It was an aberration rather than the norm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A horrible aberration. And maybe it's a 2% aberration, a 10% aberration. You know, it's nowhere near those kinds of numbers. You can't say, oh, there's going to be assholes. There's going to be assholes in every group. I mean, no, that's an excuse, which is not the way to do it. But when it does occur, when it does happen, you do need to draw attention to it. It is essential to draw attention and say, this is what's happening. We need to be aware. But the sky isn't falling. These are aberrations we have to fix. I'm taking my football and going home.
To me, this is like many other events of its kind I've been to, science fiction, Comic Con, media events. I personally haven't witnessed anything, but that doesn't mean anything. Again, that's just my experience, of course. I know I was a little bit trepidatious coming here, to be honest.
That's unfortunate that the influence is equivalent to American news, that you're walking through the supermarket aisles thinking, which one of these breakfast cereals is going to kill me? Which parking space is the most dangerous for my children?
You don't drink, for reasons you've gone into your show. And last night when you were leaving us at the bar downstairs at about 3 o'clock, that there was a gentleman talking to you who had a few. Yeah. I'd had a couple myself, and all I could think was, this must happen to George a lot. He's completely sober. It's 3 a.m. Someone drunk is taking a long time to get to a point that they may not even get to. And George is doing a good job of being polite. How long you had to do that for? I mean, you've been doing that all your life now, because your teenage friends would have got smashed.
In a weird way, as the record keeper, I almost enjoyed that. That was my job. It was like some weird tribe, some cave tribe, that the sober record keeper, that is his. He is the keeper of the stories of the night of debauchery, who will relate to us in future times what happened here.
Is it hard not to feel superior sometimes when people are deliberately making their intellect inferior by drinking?
Very much. That's one of those other skeptical things. I was in a relationship once where the person said to me, he's like, I worry that you don't drink because it makes you feel superior. And I had to say, you know, it. Yeah, on a certain level it does, which it's unhealthy to have that idea, to use it that way. And do I justify the other 20 reasons I could give why I don't drink, but that ultimately there is that little superiority of, I am succeeding in this challenge I've put to myself of not drinking, so I am better than you.
So is it like Pendulette says, the alcohol just ceases to, it's just background, you don't even see it. It's just something that just doesn't exist to you. It's not an option, so you just don't see it. It becomes invisible.
There's no temptation whatsoever. I'm never tempted to have a drink. I'm never tempted to smoke a joint or something. It just doesn't enter into it because it's such a non-option. The only influence it does have is when someone is maybe crossing a line and getting a little bit too personal or getting or really dragging on or not understanding that my very obvious signals are, we need to end this conversation. I'm going to move on to the next one. But even then, there's always usually a good story you get out of it. And I don't mind being the sober one and kind of watching. Because it's fascinating, too, that the same person who will be very shy, very reserved during the lectures, you know, will completely come up to me and have the booze-based courage to ask a question, which then I'm happy to answer. Maybe it's a jealousy or a fear also that if I were to get inebriated, would I really enjoy it, number one? Would I feel a certain freedom? And then would it delegitimize all these years of being sober? So that might be a fear too, you know. So it's a very interesting, honest topic to kind of like to talk about.
Well, look, what I like to say is I have had some of the worst nights of my life on drugs and alcohol, but some of the best nights of my life on that. And I've also had them sober as well. And I've always had a fairly liberal attitude towards drugs and alcohol. I've got every vice except gambling. Gambling, I can't grab onto that one for some reason. I've seen, obviously, here in Vegas, a lot of people get very excited about it. That one doesn't fire the serotonin in the brain. Yeah. What is, you think, your worst vice?
Apart from masturbation, probably that's actually my best.
His PSI level is fantastic.
Right. I have a food issue. I have all bizarre food issues, which I managed to control. And I've had some lovely, lovely fans and friends, especially here, walk up and very tactfully want to talk to me about my food issues. It's very sweet. I mean, one woman in particular came up who was...
This is interesting because I listen to your show a lot and I hear you talk about food and I would never consider you having food issues.
Yeah, it's the embarrassment of eating in front of other people, using food as a reward. I'm fully aware of all these things and I'm aware that I do them. I mean, to me, some of the happiest moments are sort of alone with a large bowl of something, of some type of...
For me, it's salt and vinegar chips. I'm a big fan of that. I like the classic French onion, like highly engineered dairy product dip is good. That's kind of good. Yeah. And watching the Nazis fight with someone on the History Channel and getting beaten. Like, that's sort of the guilty pleasure for me. And, you know, they're always fighting someone. I mean, you click on the History Channel, they're always finding a new angle on the Second World War, no matter what. Hitler's dog, he's back.
Most of the, you know, writers, especially American sort of fiction writers or historical fiction writers, would have invented Hitler because they just would have had to. But, yeah.
So you're also in show business. You've got in the back of your mind, and I've got to keep myself in a condition for being on camera. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I went through a big weight loss right around 30, about 10 years ago or so, where I lost like 40 pounds. And I saw a video of myself at my sister's wedding. So I saw this video and I thought, all right, time to do something, and kind of got onto a regime and fixed some bad habits that I had in terms of just day-to-day eating. Unfortunately, I think when I did that, I built in a couple little, you know, the famous cheat day, where you are very stringent and hardcore and you get results, you know, but I can go days without food, which then has this kind of Python reward system that I do, which is very unhealthy. And I know it's unhealthy and I realize, but it works.
It's very illogical and irrational.
Exactly, exactly. Might be the best example of my illogic. We all carry that on some level, especially people that, like you said, you know, you're on camera, so you are looking at yourself. That is an issue which is part of your success, your failure, your whatever, the consideration. You know, it's unfortunate and it's horrible and it's completely different from what it takes to write a song, but that I know I have to look a certain way to maybe get that song played by someone, and it's awful.
So this is where we can loop it into how everyone can use that, because you've overcome things like this. You've managed to do things. What's something that the people can overcome that with? Like, 'cause, I mean, the temptation of alcohol, that's never been an issue for you. How do you find the inner strength to not have that cheat day and to get on with it, even though, you know, you've got to suffer in a small way to do it?
Right. The food thing... You know, you address what the craving is actually about. Is the craving for the item of food, or is the craving for the sense of maybe peace or sense of ease or Like, I know when I sit down with a pizza in front of the TV, for that next 45 minutes, like, that is my that is my responsibility in my world. Logically, what's the issue I'm getting away from? Am I...
Oh, hang on. Now, you are not giving us the answer we want, George. Okay. You are giving us a long answer that will, A, mean education. The answer is going to be we have to think introspectively. Maynard, you've got to look at yourself in the mirror and think, it's okay, you're not 30 anymore. I don't want to hear that.
Okay.
Want to hear, I want the silver bullet.
All right. Think of the color purple, and that'll do it. You just picture the color purple, and it'll solve everything for you. That's my best advice.
Which is kind of what TAM's all about. You guys are fighting against that, because I've had so many conversations with people, and they're going, oh, well, we need to educate people. We do that. And go, well, yes, but people don't want to be educated. That's a sad fact sometimes.
It is. And the most efficient answers are usually very unsexy. You know, how do you learn to play the piano? Someone approaches me, and they see me playing guitar, and they say, I could never do that. I could never do that. And I have to say, I've been doing this since I was 10 years old, you know, an hour a day for 30 years. It is a cumulative thing. You know, if you wanted to learn guitar, if you sat for 10 minutes every day for 2 years, your guitar playing would miraculously improve. You know, your sense of rhythm and pitch would miraculously improve. It's like the least sexy answer. I mean, a good example is I wanted to be a better piano player. So I knew if I purchased a piano, as long as it was weighted keys, I didn't care about the quality of the sound or whatever, as long as it was a weighted piano that I could get legitimate technique on and had it in the house, so that when I'm waiting for the microwave popcorn to pop, when I'm waiting for my laundry to finish, when I'm waiting for a phone call, whatever, I can twiddle for 2 minutes. No study books, nothing official, just twiddling the way I learned guitar when I was in college. And lo and behold, you know, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day, 2 years later, I'm like, you know, I'm better than I was 2 years ago. Very unsexy answer. Well, I saw this wonderful YouTube video that talks about the value of 30 minutes of exercise a day. And not exercise in terms of full out, you know, weight training, just walking or at the very least standing. All the statistics and numbers showing how people with diabetes, as long as they exercised half hour a day, it improved. Erectile dysfunction, depression, every possible type of thing that there is an equivalent medicine for, speaking of pharmaceuticals to companies, everything that has the equivalent medication, almost as effective, if not more effective than the corresponding medicine, was 30 minutes of moderate exercise would be as effective, if not more effective. The video ended with the person talking saying, if you take nothing else away from this, think of it this way. I'm asking you to limit your sitting and sleeping to 23 and a half hours a day. How can you argue with that? How can you possibly say anything to that? Because when it's placed in front of you like that, you go, there's no excuse. I love that. That is the silver bullet. That to me is genius. That is what I hope we as skeptics can find in every subject.
And George, on a personal level, just to wrap this up, because I've taken a lot of your time here, and I really appreciate it. You know, you've been working hard enough here without having some guy in a badly fitted suit and a William Shatner tie.
Oh, that deserves that. Yes,
yeah, that's pretty damn good there. Yeah, coming along and wasting more of your time there. I mean, you've got more drunks to talk to at the bar. This show might happen. The TV show might happen within a 6 month time frame. Would you like to take the podcasting to another level? In fact, I don't know why a radio station hasn't snapped you up. Half hour national syndicated radio show would be in the reach of. So why hasn't this happened? To me, it seems odd. I mean, I'm in a land where there's middlemen that will sell anybody to anything.
Maybe that's what'll happen after this.
I mean, the success of Two and a Half Men, really.
I mean, I know. I'm not sure. And it's a weird wish, you know, that Chinese saying of be careful what you wish for because it might come true. My dad keeps telling me this and putting it to me. And he used the example of Dave Chappelle. I don't know if you're familiar with the American comedy.
A very intense comedy show. And I think it sort of got too much for him and he blew out in the second season, didn't he, or something?
He filmed some interstitial bits for the second season, was, in essence, once you count sort of all the ancillary money, offered the equivalent of $50 million to work. And he walked away because he realized that he wasn't doing what he wanted to. He was going to be responsible when someone gives you a check for $50 million. That doesn't come without a phone book's worth of responsibilities and caveats and things. And he said, I'm walking away. And my dad has told me, you're not famous. You're not nationally successful. You're not successful on a large scale. You have a very small, very loyal, but very small following. But you are doing exactly what you want to do. My records, my albums sound exactly the way I want them to. The podcast sounds exactly the way it is. It's the length I want it to be. If I want to do it for a week, I can do it. If I want to do a two-hour show, if I want to do an entire show that's just Dark Side of the Moon on piano, I can do it.
Many people don't get the chance to do that in their life as the same as not get up on stage. I've had a brief chance while here at TAM, thanks to the people that have put in to listen to Skeptic Zone, to come here and report on this for people. I've spoken to Adam Curry, who works on the No Agenda show, which could be far away from what many skeptics would consider a point of view. Him and John C. Dvorak wake up in the morning and their rent is paid by the people who deliberately give their money to their podcast. And you are living a life because of what you do, and it's paid for by others that like what you do. How can you describe to anyone who doesn't do that how that feels?
To me, that is the ultimate success. Because ultimately, any national success, TV success, radio success, record sales success is transitional. Because you can never be that. I mean, no one is at the top. Even the Rolling Stones, who've been doing it for 50 years, you know, how many of them are there? There's them. So odds are, even if you are hugely successful, that will end. What are you willing to pay for that? To me, to be able to do exactly what I want to do and not have to worry that I've modified my artistic endeavors, and I can have a show that I'll record that, or an album that I'll record that 2 years later, 5 years later, someone will approach to me, a stranger will approach to me, you know, in Vegas and say, episode 90 from 4 years ago, you did this sketch that was I thought it was so funny. Or you did a show about losing your friend and the grief you went through, and that helped me get through something that I went through. It's priceless. It's priceless. And I have to remind myself of that sometimes because it's very insular. I mean, you sit and you record, you sit with a microphone on your own, and a lot of the feedback doesn't come instantly or doesn't even come eventually.
Interestingly enough, but the way podcasts are listened to, sometimes in the car, but it's normally a one-on-one basis, which is why you tend to get people thinking they own you more, because you're talking directly to them into those earbuds. There's a slight different dynamic even from radio, broadcast radio.
Absolutely. I call it a one-way friendship that I am fine with, because if someone is listening to my show, whatever, 45 minutes a week, an hour a week, they have decided that is what they're putting into the friendship. Even though I don't know them, I can't hear what they're saying back to the show.
Yeah. Well, for example, I've met you twice. This is the second time I've met you. I met you at TAM Australia. And I feel I know you quite well through listening to the podcast and from a couple of emails back and forth and a Skype conversation over a 2-year period.
Yeah, I just brought that up last night when I saw you coming in. I said, there's a perfect example of how tremendous this community is, number one, or events like TAM are, or how wonderful the virtual world can be. You know, we met 2 years ago for 5 hours, 8 hours total, maybe. I mean, that's being generous in terms of the time we spent together. One-hour Skype conversation. Yeah. And yet when we saw each other, big bear hug, it was great. It was like, here we go. And we continue. We pick up where we stopped and we continue. Not that I want this to happen, but 5 years could go by. And I think if we didn't see each other with the occasional email and listening to the show. And
we'd have a rough idea where things were.
Absolutely. We'd see each other and continue the conversation. I love that. I love that.
A lot of people haven't quite get the knack yet of Facebook being their world that they want to present. Most people present everything on it like it's an online diary. Remember you used to go to a girl's place when you were younger and you'd be sitting in a bedroom and she'd get a book of poetry out from under the bed and you'd have to listen to that poetry for various reasons that I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, listeners. And now that happens online now with Facebook or with blogs and things. And people just overshare, where people haven't quite worked out what to share and what not to share. Yeah. Do you think that's an artist that maybe people that perform like us kind of understand, that you're creating a reality on Facebook that isn't supposed to be a reality, where people who don't perform think that, I've got to tell everything on there because that's what it is?
The editor is sometimes the most important part of any artist, if not the most important part. I talk about doing exactly the show I want to do. Exactly the show I want to do would be just talking about Frank Zappa for 5 hours every show. Now, that would be great. Or talking about Yes, or talking about, you know, whatever.
Gentle Giant or Van de Graaff Generator. Yeah, sure. And the small rat hole here, one of the episodes where you had your birthday and you did Dark Side of the Moon. Mm-hmm. I was at my friend Jeff's place after work, having a few beers, and we're playing that, and we're listening to it. And after a little while, fuck it, how old is he? And he's fucking spent a whole day doing this fucking, we just had a day at work that hadn't been one of the better ones. Yeah. And here we were listening to this guy who was younger than us, had enough time to just whip up this Dark Side of the Moon thing and put it on a podcast. And it was like, it was a very funny moment. It was like, as a form of praise, but it was so annoying that you had time to do that. On what birthday was it? Your 21st or?
My 40th, yeah. I remember thinking while doing it, like, this will be, I want to remember this day. That was a 9-hour sort of effort. And there are few things I would rather have done that day.
You live and high you fly, but only if you ride the tide. Balanced on the biggest wave, you race towards an early grave.
And I got to share it with my, you know, a couple thousand listeners, who then maybe shared it with a couple more, and it got to piss you off. So that's, you know, that's always good. So.
It just made us really envious. Man, this guy, he's doing this, and we're just sitting there having a beer, and it's getting cold. Just to finish off again, I'm trying. I guess there was the monogamy thing I wanted to bring up, because you had a great chat about monogamy once, which has not been touched on your show ever since. You basically said that if someone was gay and they came to you and you said, "I'll just sleep with a whole bunch of people of the same sex, get out of your life, and then go back to being straight again," and you equated that to if someone didn't feel like they could commit to monogamy and said, "Well, just go have a sex with a whole bunch of people and then stop and just have sex with one person," you're equivocating that argument.
Yeah, my friend John brought that up. John Blesso. And he brought up that example, which I had never thought of before.
No, and and you haven't touched on that since. I thought you might have got some mail about it or an Ask George about it.
And you wonder how many people are. I mean, unhappy is a very loaded word, you know, because what ultimately, I mean, I'm unhappy within every day. On some level, at some point, there is unhappiness.
Any psychiatrist will tell you that happy is just one of the states that you should expect on a daily basis or on a regular basis. And maybe that's why people over-medicate on antidepressant drugs, because they aren't used to just being not happy. Not unhappy, but not happy.
Right. Realizing that it is a, if not a roller coaster ride, at least a lovely drive through the hills. It's going to have some shadows and going to have some, you know, some cold and some warm.
Dennis Leary, No Cure for Cancer, he said you have the orgasm, you smoke the cigarette, you eat the cookie, you go to bed, you wake up next day, go to work.
I think Ray Charles said this first, that, you know, you pay me not to play music. You pay me to fly to the venue. You know, you pay me to set up the piano and do the sound check and then do the press before and after. So for us, it's the same thing. I know the payment that I get for a musical performance is all of the ancillary stuff, carrying my drums up two flights of stairs.
And I should finish now. And look, I'd like you to have it speak directly to the people that have put in to send me here and just have a brief chat about what you think of the Australian Skeptic Movement, the Skeptic Zone, that kind of thing, in a nutshell, because they paid to get me here. And like, could you let them know that I have been working hard?
Maynard has been with a microphone grafted to his arm the entire time I've seen him. Yeah, working very, very hard.
This is actually interview number 71.
We're, I guess, just at the halfway point. So yeah. So we are 71 interviews in, so there's going to be about 150 of these for you fine folks. I, with an absolute dingo-eaten sense of joy, revel in the fact that the number two country of my downloads is Australia. It's the U.S., Australia, and then England, which obviously for language purposes makes sense. But the fact that you guys beat out Great Britain, I just love it. I love it. I have the most fond, beautiful memories of my time in Australia. The conference in Sydney itself, and then going to Melbourne and Canberra and Cairns and Adelaide, and as well as hopping over to New Zealand and doing two cities over there. Wonderful people, wonderful time, so enthusiastic. And the kind of people that would collect money to send a loony like you over here, you know, how can I not love that? How can you not respect that?
And what difference do we have in skepticism to the American way? I've asked a lot of the Americans, in what way is our approach different, or the way we look at things? Can you put that into words?
Oh, that's interesting. That's a great question. Is it, oh boy, a joie de vivre maybe, that American skepticism doesn't have its. I think it's less nerdy, but
is
more
there certain larrikinism, certain sense of humor that we have.
I think so. I think there's a vibrancy and a joy. I think there, and I hope that's not insulting, and I mean that with just complete fondness. That there is a certain excitement of there are other people on the planet that feel this way too, which we have as a movement. But I think you guys really have that, and that was that feeling in Sydney of walking in, you know, and hearing that first round of applause for Randy when the 680 people that were there just were through applause saying, thank you for coming. Thank you for flying the 14 hours, you 80-year-old man, you. It was overwhelming, the sense of appreciation. And I think that kind of registers not only to the sense of appreciation of individuals, but to the sense of the appreciation of the facts, the sense of appreciation of how you can be skeptical and how things actually work. So I think you guys all sort of share that, and that's very inspiring, very inspiring.
We'd love to see you in our country again sometime, and maybe we'll even make it back here next year.
I have to come back because I feel like I only saw a skosh of a touch.
And because I'm doing, as part of the Disbelievers and the Skeptic Zone, the music of TAM Las Vegas, I've been asking a lot of skeptics, and you're okay because of the music thing, but you ask a skeptic about who they think is physically attractive, like I did with DJ Grothy, and he had a lot of trouble answering that question.
Really?
And I said, come on, who do you think's attractive? And he's like, gee, I usually have stock answers for almost anything, but no one's ever asked me that.
Like people that are here? Or
no,
just
no, of anybody. Who'd you like a photo of? I said, yeah. I said, hot soccer players, they're great. And he went, yeah. He did eventually answer that. I can't remember. Oh, he said his partner. I said, oh, come on, everyone says that next. He was great with that. But when I ask skeptics about music, and I'm not asking about a skeptical song or something, I said, what's your favorite song and give me a reason why I should play it now. That really surprises people. Now, I'm asking you that question. It wouldn't surprise you. What one song and a little story behind it would you like me to play now?
Not skeptical?
Just a favorite song of yours, yeah.
There is something about the song, I'm probably going to date myself, but there's something about the song Siberian Katru by Yes.
Wow. Now, see, my Yes knowledge is limited to after the later period when Trevor Horn joined them back.
Sure. So, 9125 and after that. Yeah. But if you go to Close to the Edge, which is a three-song album, it's 42 minutes. The first track is 21 minutes, and then, there's three songs in this record. The one song, which is called Siberian Katru, it, to me, encapsulates all the best possible elements of what that 70s prog rock could be.
They didn't know they were prog rock, and that's what makes it prog rock.
Yes. They were doing their versions of Supreme melodies. They were doing Motown. They were doing Beatles songs as if transmogrified through Puccini or Bach or something like that. Gilbert and Sullivan through Motown, through Bach. Siberian Katru has a very funky feel to it, even though it's a multimeter piece, and there's a lovely development.
If you fade that out halfway through, that's kind of annoying, like fading our symphony, isn't it? So I wouldn't want that to happen. Is there something? Okay. I'm not saying that it's wrong to have a 7-minute song. I'm just not quite sure I have room for it.
A different direction. We'll go with Making Flippy Floppy by Talking Heads.
It would have been on Stop Making Sense, wouldn't it? Did they do it live?
They did it in the movie version of Stop Making Sense. It wasn't on the album, the live album Stop Making Sense, but the record before, it's on Speaking in Tongues.
Life During Wartime, I find, is a very powerful song from them. It's a driving rhythm that you don't often get from them. That's what I like about Life During Wartime. Yes. But what Making Flippy Floppy, why is that?
Making Flippy Floppy, the lyrics are one of those wonderful non-rhyming David Byrne lyrics. There's a couple little couplets in there, but for the most part, it's non-rhyming. Yet it's very, very rhythmic, very easy to memorize, even though there's no rhyme to it. It is constructed of cliches, the way a lot of his sort of lyrics of that time are. And yet there is nothing cliche about it, because he's using them as word painting or word blocks, assemblage, sort of the way that if you were to cut up a phone book, or like a magnet poetry, sort of like that. Lyrically, that's fascinating to me. Rhythmically, what's happening is very funky, very danceable, very interesting. They're using the guitars literally as a percussion instrument for sections of it, where they're just palming the strings, not having the strings sound a pitch, but just scratching across the muted strings, almost like a güiro or some Latin instrument, Latin percussion instrument, which provides this driving rhythm. And it's just the bass line has a very funky yet obtuseness to it. So it's not flowing, it's not lyrical the way like a James Brown funky bass line might be, and yet it's reminiscent of that and has a very semi-atonal nature to it. And all these pieces combined, like most Talking Heads songs or most successful songs in general, but especially Talking Heads, it's greater than the parts. You know, it's each individual thing adds to this collage that then you sort of step back and you realize, oh, it's a face. You know, it's like those photo mosaic pictures where, yeah, it's a thousand photos of surfers, but when you step back, you see the large, you know, sunset over the ocean kind of thing. The oral version of that is what's going on in that song specifically.
Look, let's have a listen to it now. And I've got this kind of an idea that you might be a really bad dancer, are you?
I love to dance. I love, my mom at a very early age said dancing is essential. So she taught me how to tango and cha-cha and polka and waltz.
So you can actually dance quite gracefully, relatively.
You'd have to ask someone else. But I love dancing. I don't like club dancing.
That's what I was thinking of there, where you do your own thing then.
My fear is, number one, club dancing, sort of the dub, or that gets very repetitive, and I lose interest very quickly.
Right, for a live drummer, of course.
Yeah, you know, like the interest to me is in the structure of the song. Mm-hmm. So if you put on a Stevie Wonder record, if you put on Songs in the Key of Life, I will dance like a maniac, so much so that I actually start to legitimately embarrass myself. There is a Talking Heads cover band, which is local to where I live, and I almost can't go see them. Or if I have to kind of sort of force myself to sit in the back, because it is my equivalent of a religious experience, because I know this material so well, and they reproduce it so well that I am just in front, drenched in sweat. There is someone posted a YouTube video that I could show you which jumping hat is me. And it's like the full 45-minute set, and I am just in bliss. So I love to dance. I never get a chance to do it because I'm always playing.
Yeah, because you're the drummer. So I'm going to imagine you dancing around at home, George Clooney style, in your undies, thinking about playing the bongos, looking like Adam West. And isn't that a great combination? George Harab, George Clooney, Adam West, bongos, like the guy in the Mad, 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 Mad World. Mama, mama, I'm coming. Him.
Yes.
See, I would like my life to be that scene where there's the girl in the bikini and he's playing the bongos at home, the phone rings. And that's his afternoon. If the phone didn't ring, he was just going to play the bongos afternoon with the girl in the bikini. I wanted to be that when I was seven. I wanted to be that the rest of my life.
Perfect, perfect. I think that's the image to go out on. Yes, yes. Amen.
Thank you. And where can people find you and look for you?
If you would be interested in the Geologic Universe, you can just go to georgeharab.com. H-R-A-B is the way you spell my last name. If you just Google that, the first 146,000 things are me. So it's a unique enough thing. But from there, you can get my podcast, iTunes, all my albums, the little book that I wrote, and all kinds of YouTube stuff and whatever. So
And the other George you have after that is a conveyancing lawyer from Detroit, and he's really pissed off.
Corporate cleaner, and yeah, he keeps trying to get his web hits, and it's just not happening. Just not happening.
Get in line. Nothing can come between us. Nothing gets you down. Nothing strikes your fancy. Everything looks good.
maynard.com.au. Hey, you!